So hello, everybody. I am sitting here with Ben Hatke. Ben is a best-selling author, artist. He is mostly known for his series, Zeta the Space Girl, and also Mighty Jack. I was introduced to his work by Andrew Gould, whose opinion is always unfailing to me. Whatever he suggests to me, I immediately look at it. And I found in his stories with my kids as well, just a wonderful, boisterous storytelling, deep understanding of storytelling and of myth and of fairy tale, but also connection to science fiction, just very well-rounded storytelling. So if you have kids, even as adults, I enjoyed them reading them as adults myself. And so I'm really happy to be able to talk to him. He has a new book coming out next month called Julia's House Goes Home, which is a third part of a series of picture books. So you can also check that out and make sure to get that as the months coming along. So I'm looking forward to this conversation.
This is Jonathan Peugeot. Welcome to the Symbolic World.
So Ben, thanks for agreeing to talk to me. I was a little surprised that you agreed because, you know, you're kind of a big shot, I guess, in the art world. But I was really, and I found out that your wife, at least you and your wife, have watched my videos and that your wife kind of follows me. So that was a very interesting connection for me.
Yes, you were a big shot in our household, apparently. Well, I'm saying apparently. No, but I mean, like, I've often walked into the kitchen and been like, oh, it's Jonathan Peugeot's voice again.
So, yeah, it's funny how these things work because it's the same. When I got the Zeta and Mighty Jack books, then my kids just loved them, like devoured them. And then the same thing, when I told them that I was going to talk to you, they were like, oh, my dad's a big shot because he gets to talk to them.
It's kind of comic books.
Yeah, it's just funny how it works. And so, I mean, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you kind of fell into this world, and then we'll just jump in.
I was thinking about, like, well, not that I'm thinking about this all the time, but I was actually thinking about it yesterday because I was making my dad has a YouTube account now.
Really?
Yes, he is an architect, and he's an architect that, oh boy, if he listens to this, he's tried to retire a few times, but it never sticks, right? He's always doing stuff, and he's started a little YouTube account, the Frog Pond School of Design, which has its own backstory, but it's interesting architectural tidbits. All the videos are like 3 minutes. Mm. And be like, what is an ingle nook? How do we control sway in very tall buildings, right? Just really like stuff like that. And then stories from the Renaissance. But I've been trying to like promote these because I really like him doing these videos. And I was thinking like, and I was writing a little bit about it. And I was like, and my dad, being an architect, is the first person who, because I deal in storytelling, but I think a lot about words and pictures and how they dance or work together or move together to tell stories. And so like, you know, my own legend that I tell myself about this was with my mom, who would always bring me to the library because she had a big cloth bag that she would always fill up the week's reading. Had a lot of stories read to me as a child, a lot of Roald Dahl, a lot of the Narnia Chronicles. The BFG was huge in our house, and I'm now reading it to my daughter. But my dad always, when I would ask him a question, he was always much more inclined to pull. He had always would have pens and note cards in the breast pocket of his shirt. And he would always like pull one out. He was more comfortable explaining something through drawings, as comfortable as with word. And so that I feel like in my deep, deep recesses of my brain, that's where I realized like drawing is not only something that you do for fun, but it's like this incredibly powerful form of communication. And then, you know, obviously, like so many of us, I would read the Sunday funnies in the morning, the comic strips every morning, right? Like, and you know, there Garfield moved to Calvin and Hobbes, which was brilliant.
Yeah,
Calvin and Hobbes moved to you know, a lot of the Marvel stuff. I found like Spider-Man comics, got really into that. But another big one was ElfQuest, by Wendy and Richard Pini. And I had the great memories of riding my bike up to the used bookstore when I was like 10, 11, 12, and looking through the stacks, trying to find because I didn't have the collections. I would have to
find. Oh, you'd have to find the actual comics back in
the Marvel reprints, and like, so there were always gaps in my knowledge of what happened in that part of the story, and so also, and it was the first thing that really showed me like long form. That was my first experience with like long form storytelling in comics. Yeah, so you know, comics ended up always being something that I could. I don't know. As you grow up, you get positive reinforcement with certain things. Whenever I made comics, people enjoyed them. So I made more comics. And like even in college, like one thing I did quite a bit was I would always tape a sheet of 11 by 17 paper up in our bathroom, in like our shared dorm bathroom. And I had this ridiculous comic that I would just keep adding to. And that's positive reinforcement too, because I would hear people laughing from the bathroom.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, now I'm going to put more into this comic. And in our bathroom, you know, like other people would come use it just kind of for that. Yeah, and then, yeah, and so, yeah, so there's like the sort of like, and sort of like, I'm thinking a lot about influence and stuff, and there's definitely just a thread of story that runs through, I don't know, runs through my life, even though I didn't do art school. I studied history, but then, you know, when I was doing freelance art and design after I was married, and just starting out, I was doing just a lot of like design work, like Photoshop work and illustrations for textbooks, things like that. Mm-hmm. And then got to this point where I wasn't getting any better. But at that point I had met a group of artists online, the flight guys. So I kind of got my break. There was an anthology called Flight, mm-hmm. where a bunch of artists of different, we all seem to have like a similar, we all grown up loving the Studio Ghibli movies,
yeah,
Miyazaki movies, and we all kind of had a similar sensibility. And at that point, there wasn't much in the way of middle grade comics, like young people's comics. This was, and so this is like all these guys are there. It's Kazu Kibuishi who went on to do the Amulet series, like Reina who does Smile and all these things.
Oh, okay.
So this whole kind of movement came out of this message board that Kazu started, and this anthology of comics that we all put short stories into. Simultaneously around that time, we spent a year in Italy in my wife's grandmother's house, which is, you know, like vacant, like she had passed away, but we kind of was restoring that house in the mountains. And so I spent some time during that time in Florence. So the other side of that coin is I was spending a lot of time learning to paint, like portrait and figure painting, sort of a school that was, you know, connected to the lineage of John Singer Sargent and stuff like this. So yeah, those are kind of the two sides of that coin. And then in comics, just to round out a kind of a story that I've let go, in comics, you know, the manga comics kind of were coming in and becoming very popular. And Jeff Smith's Bone, I don't know if you're familiar with
Bone. Yeah.
Okay, Bone was getting big too.
Yeah.
But it was over, like it had ended, and Scholastic picked it up, and there just wasn't a lot else. And there were mostly comics were still like superhero comics, and they have their own distributor, like the Diamond distributor. But mainstream book publishers were like seeing the Scholastic get the money from Bone and the manga stuff coming over, and they were like, "Wow, there's money in these comics." And we just thought like all the Flight people happened to be in the right space to sign up these books, really on a song. Like, what had I done? I had done a few short stories. I had done Zeta the Space Girl as a web comic, but like not a reliably updating web comic. Like there wasn't a ton, but they signed me up for a book because they wanted books. And and from there I was able to keep doing it. So now I'm making comics and picture books and prose stories and other stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because hearing you mention your influences and just the kind of zeitgeist around what you were doing, all of a sudden it just makes so much sense, you know, in terms of Bone and all this imagery. Like even when you talk about Miyazaki, I mean, I realize how then all of a sudden it hit me that Zita is really the kind of feminine character that you find in a Miyazaki movie, this kind of just boisterous, joyful, in someone who influences others too, like who has this kind of magnetism that is able to kind of attract others to her cause, you know. And she, anyway, so it makes a lot of sense. I really, and ElfQuest as well, in this kind of long form. There's something about your work, really, when you talk about your father and this architecture side to it, like I really feel that in the page compositions, you really have a sense of flow in terms of storytelling, but also in terms of general composition for the pages. Yeah. You can see that the pages are composed as standalone images. You could almost think of them that way, which is something that not a lot of comic artists are able to pull off very well. The architectural element is there, it's present in the sense that even the comic pages, the way that you compose them, there's a sense of unity in the page itself. And so there's this flow of movement, because I was reading again the Mighty Jack series yesterday. There's a flow of movement, constant movement, especially in the Jack story, where it's just this, it's almost like a chase story, right? It just kind of moves the whole time. But then this ends up being composed within the pages, and you feel this flow of the story in the composition of the panels, but also the pages themselves. So that's makes it very compelling to read.
Oh, I'm glad you find that, because like I that's something I think about a lot. Composition is something, it grabs the hold of that geeky fine tuning part of your brain where you're like, I can do this right, I can do this better. And I think a lot about the flow. I think a lot about the flow of an eye through the page, like you say. I think a lot about the top left hand panel. I design my pages as spreads.
Yeah.
So I don't do individual pages. When I do my thumbnails, I'm looking at an open page every time. And I think a lot about the top left hand panel, whatever's going on at the top left, and then whatever's going on at the bottom right, and then wiggle you across the whole spread that way. And also just keeping, like, it's interesting to me. I don't know if it's interesting to anybody else, but like, I really do, like, there's so much you can do with composition, and there's so much you can do that can make it even more, as with prose, you can have difficult to access prose, which is also very rich, right? Or you can have, like, I always admire authors like Neil Gaiman and C.S. Lewis and stuff like that, who write richly, but with simple, accessible prose. The Hobbit is an example. Oh, the difference between The Hobbit and, oh gosh, what's another example? I like the Brian Jacques Redwall books, but I found them really difficult to read aloud. But then, like, The Hobbit, like, even when I'm tired, if I'm going to read aloud a chapter of The Hobbit, I'm like, yeah, I'm in, it's fine. It flows, it's beautiful, but it's got it's not overly complicated.
Yeah.
And that's what I think. I want my comics to be accessible to non-comics readers, right? I've noticed, like, and this is a real aside, but it kind of ties in. I'm very excited for Marvel is doing a short series of Hawkeye. Mm-hmm. For Disney Plus, and I love it. And they seem to be using a lot of the Matt Fraction, David Asia, series run on Hawkeye to influence this show, which is one of my favorite superhero comics of all. And because it is minimalist in its drawings, but like super rich and interesting in its in what it's doing with composition. And there is one specific one where the dog solves a murder mystery, and you're getting everything from the dog's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's all symbols of what he's smelling. And it's very close to black and white. Like, it's the color palette's way down. When people are talking, it's all scribbled out except for words that the dog would pick up on.
Yeah.
Go. Clint, whatever it is. And it's a miracle that it's legible. It's a miracle that you can read it. It's also kind of like, it's hard to read. Like I think it's not beginning comics readers reading, but it's so interesting. I read that one and I was like, oh, I didn't know you could do that. And it's pretty brilliant.
There's something about, when I think about the your pieces too. I mean, when I think about Bone, it just makes a lot of sense. There's a sparsity of words and a lot of emphasis on character, making the drawings also not kind of like the marble chiseled type of drawing, makes the characters more accessible immediately, because you're able to tap into caricature and to, you know, just having the shape of the character be related to their personality. So you don't have to, you don't have to explain it a lot. You just see them, and then they catch you, and then they can enter into the action right away without having to give backstory or to talk about, you know, what their motive or try to show their motivations. You almost get it from the drawing itself. So it creates this sparsity that you're able to keep the action moving the whole time with very few words, and not a few, but like very sparse words. But you follow the story completely.
Like, how much story can I tell before I get to the words? Because one of the, you know, like the other concept I think about a lot is, you know, art is usually defined by its limitations, right? Mm-hmm. And wonder is when you create something within those limitations that seems impossible. So when, that's why we get obsessive about the soft drapery and flesh in marble sculptures, right? It's crystal, it's marble, but somehow they're pulling softness out of the hardness. And that's why everybody geeked out about perspective when they finally cracked perspective in Renaissance painting. It's a flat thing, but it's got depth. Oh my gosh. You know, like that's magic there. And with comics, it's like one of the challenges is that, you know, you've got a page and you're pressed for space and the words will crowd very, very easily, right? Crowd out what, and so the words and the images have to be working together. And one of the things I think about a lot is gesture, like the way we read each other's gestures and body language, right? Yeah. Body language. How much can I tell you about what's going on with the character? They don't have to say I'm angry. If they say that, then I'm not doing my job.
You're not making a comic, right? Well, at least it's reduced from what it could be. Yeah. So one of the things that really impressed me that I enjoyed seeing in both the Zita and the Jack stories is the manner in which you play with the relationship between adventure and risk or danger and possibility. You know, in the Mighty Jack story, one of the main tropes is that they grow this garden. And this garden is like an alien garden, and it is murderous. Like it's super dangerous, and it could kill them. But then, out of this kind of murderous, dangerous, wild garden, they're able to gather power. Let's say they're able to kind of get both power, and then let's say test themselves in a way that refines their character. And so, I think it's important to understand that. To me, it's something that I found very beautiful, at least for a kid's story, especially in a world where kids are just inside all the time. Like this is our world. Like we have a world of safety, let's say, where people are obsessed with safety, but you seem to kind of explore this danger as also possibility for development, let's say. I don't know if you want to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. And also, and also it's like expanding their world, right? Like the garden ends up being a gateway to another world. And it's just making these kids' world larger. And yeah, that was the kind of the crux of that book. And especially when also Jack's also essentially a caretaker, right? So like, he's also got this question of like, it's not just me. Maybe he on his own as a 14-year-old kid would be like, sure, let's go crazy. It's just me on the line, right? But he's got Maddie to look after. And so that to me, that was an interesting question. Like, where does your responsibility, that fuzzy space between responsibility and, I don't know, engagement with the world, right? And it is a good question. I think it's a good question for all times.
Because even with his sister Maddie, who for people who don't know is autistic, it kind of needs to be, yeah. She needs to be watched and she needs to be taken care of. You know, the garden, this dangerous space, even for her, ends up also being the place where she has a moment where she speaks because of this garden. Like she has these little moments where she seems to kind of increase herself and it's even discover this kind of secret power, secret language that she has, you know, to talk with the dragon. There are all these little moments with Maddie where you see her kind of become more, as you said, even though she's someone who's fragile and is maybe more in danger. Yeah. Right. Jack letting her go into this dangerous world is also what makes her more as a person.
And I don't think there's an answer.
Yeah, exactly. Where the balance is. And the book you have, you really do. It's wonderful because you play with that because the garden at some point does become so dangerous that it could basically, seems like it could just destroy everything. So right. Jack has to like burn it down. But then there's also a sadness, which is that, okay, now this possibility that we had given ourselves.
And Lily is furious with him for burning it down.
Exactly. Even though it's obviously murderous when you see it, like this monster come out of the ground. It's right. Like, okay, this is
but
really.
It's also obvious that it's like, it's a magical thing that is beyond like anything that they'll ever come across probably in their lives again. So it's also like, they're both right. They're both, I don't know, at least they're both answering that question and neither of them completely wrong, I guess. I don't know. Although Lily is a little bit sneaky. Like, she has been stealing seeds from the garden and growing her own in her basement, which is funny to me.
Yeah, exactly. But so there's all of that in the story, because there's this play also. This is something that I explore a lot in my channel, where you have these kind of dangerous monsters, but then some of the monsters are, you could say, on our side, and then some of the monsters are on the other side. And so there's this interplay, for example, with the image of the dragon, who is obviously extremely dangerous, but then also ends up being an ally against the giants. And the same with the goblins, where the goblins are obviously very dangerous, and the Goblin King is a very scary character, but then they're able to kind of turn the goblins around, and they become like a tool to stop the giants from the giants from taking over. And then these demons, whatever, like, it just increases, right? It's like these, you have these, I often talk about layers of monsters in the world, where you have your monsters and then scary monsters and then cosmic monsters that are further up. And you need to kind of be attentive to the monsters that are on your side, because sometimes they're annoying and they can be a little dangerous, but if you just get rid of them, you're basically removing a veil, and then the bigger monsters are coming for you. Mm. And it's hard for people to think that way, because we tend to, how can I say this? Like, it's easy to see how people that are sometimes on the margin on in many ways are annoying, you know? And so we want to kind of cut them off, but we don't realize that there's more on the other side. Like, there's bigger things and stranger things, let's say.
Yeah. And I like to play with the idea that just because something looks monstrous doesn't make it a monster, right? Like, it doesn't make it evil.
Doesn't make it evil. Yeah. Yeah. For me, monsters are never evil. Like, not never. I mean, they're not, the idea of a monster is just something wild or something undefined or something that is beyond your understanding in the way you mentioned it. And so it's not necessarily like the cherub for me in scripture is a monster, like the cherub that guards the Ark of the Covenant, you know. And we have the saint, Saint Christopher, who's this dog-headed saint who's like obviously a monster. So we have these like holy monsters, and then there are gargoyles are a good example of kind of monsters on our side, or holy monsters that are not evil. They're just monsters, you know. Right. They're there to stop they're there to stop evil things that are bigger monsters that would want to invade, let's say, space.
Yeah, no, I do. I like my saints wild. That's cool. If you poke around, I forget where I posted it, but if you poke around, I did a Saint Nicholas once. That because he's archers, sailors, thieves, and prostitutes, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's a great combination. Like, who is this guy? Who would this guy be if I was making the character, right? Like, and I gave him like a wizard staff and a huge sword and big old coat.
Yeah, well, there's this, the image of, you see this image of Saint Nicholas, right, that slaps Arius, is one of the favorite memes to come out during Christmas time. You have a sense that Saint Nicholas is something of a defender. Yeah, that's why he defends kids and he defends the marginal, let's say. Yeah. And so tell us a little bit about what the inspiration is behind some of your stories, because obviously you have this interesting mix of a fairy tale kind of myth making with science fiction. It all kind of comes together in a very seamless way.
Yeah, it's that's the soup, right? Like, that's the thing about that a lot. Because the story I'm working on now is an underworld story, and it's a little bit structurally. I had a big meeting about it, and like everybody wanted, kind of latched on to this element where it's structurally, like, they were like, this isn't the kind of story where you examine the plot or the structure very closely, because it's very Alice in Wonderland. It's very dreamlike. Like, it's not like a three act structure kind of story, but visually, like, I'm like doubling, it's visually going to be pretty dense. And like, in that way, I was like doubling down on where does all this come from? And like, visually, it's truly the furniture of my brain. And a lot of these mm-hmm. things, he's kind of actually, this kid is traveling down into this underworld, and he actually ends up traveling back kind of through art history in a way, or through human history, but kind of through art. So anyway, it was on my mind, like, where some of this stuff comes from, or what kind of furniture is in my brain. And it's like in storytelling, I like to keep a lot of things kind of subconscious. So, and then like, once you get the story down, you're like, oh, that's where that comes from. So a lot of it's just like, but I think part of the job of the storyteller is always living, right? Like, like you can't just hole up and make stories. You have to live and experience and take in. And you're kind of a conduit, always taking in and then kind of weeding out and seeing what sticks in your own mind. And then kind of digesting all of that and then telling your story with the voice that only you have. But the like a lot of what informs your voice is the things that have stuck, managed to stick in there and hold dear.
Yeah. One of the things I tried to explain is that storytelling, let's say the patterns of storytelling just come from attention. You know, you can understand the ancient myths or the myths that have come down to us or the Bible stories or these ancient stories. The reason why we have them is because they grab people's attention. And then as they were transmitted, that attention was maintained. That is, that there's a capacity to pay attention. And so you can imagine how stories refine themselves with attention. That is, those stories that are able to keep our attention will survive the generations, and those that aren't will just kind of fade away. And then even the stories themselves will end up being refined, because as they kind of progress in time, some things become idiosyncrasies and you have to modify them so that the story can be remembered. So you end up having these really pure stories with time that just kind of happen on their own, almost through a process of natural selection, you could call it. But that you also have that in yourself, which is that the things that you remember, there's a reason why you remember them. They're not just for sentimental reasons. There's something about them which we're able to grab and keep your attention. And so, and in that laboratory in your brain or in your experience, you know, to gather that together and to bring out stories without doing it too deliberately, you know. And so let's say the hero's journey comes out without having to plan it, like where people say, oh, how does this fit with the hero's journey, let's say. But if you're an intuitive storyteller, then that pattern will just appear almost out of, it just makes sense, because it's just the things that made you care about stories in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are a couple of threads, I guess, to that. And I'm trying to decide which one to go with first. One of the things, the hero's journey stuff is interesting, but just evolution of story is to go to the earlier point, evolution of story is something, because stories live and they are passed down, and there's an interesting way that they, you know, evolve through time, based on, because stories gain power as they're retold. But they also gain, like, they're also plastic, right? They're shaped and they move as they're retold. And one of the things I take issue with when I hear, like, you know, like, you know, like corporations are owning like the stories now, but it's not entirely true, because there's so much cosplay and fanfic and freedom of people taking these stories and making them their own, right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm doing my version of Captain America. One of my favorite fan fiction comics that I've run across is, and it's gone now because the person stopped making it, and then it got old enough that it's now on the Wayback Machine. I think you can still find it. But it was called Steve Rogers' American Captain. And it was because in the early comics, he is an art student before he gets the super soldier serum. And so, and even they kind of reference that. There are a couple scenes in the Marvel movies where he's sketching.
Yeah.
Right. And so they kind of call back to that. But there's this one where, like, there's this comic and it's like a journal comic. It's like a diary comic. And it's Steve Rogers is woken up in the modern age. He thought he was going to die in that plane crash. He was like, this is my death. And so it picks him up and it's like, okay, he's this powerful guy, but he's also got PTSD from war. And he's also catching up on art. So he's like, I'm going to make a journal comic about my experiences. And it's just the most touching thing, where somebody latched onto this character and humanized him so much, like as a person. And there's one thread where he goes to a gallery show with Pepper Potts and they sit outside. It's very human. It's like, there's no battles or anything in it. They just sit outside talking about their lives. And at one point he gets kind of worked up about something, and she's like, that's really scary, because you realize he's realizing in his mind, there's part of his mind that's still 95 pounds. Right.
Yeah.
And he doesn't realize that sitting next to Pepper, if he's like, and then that she's going to be like, you could
kill me
with Iron Man.
Yes.
So like, there's a lot of people doing that, and like, just taking these stories and making them their own. But then with the hero's journey, I got into this once, a discussion about this, kind of with like a group of onlookers about the hero's journey and stuff like that. And like, I feel like I have since kind of refined my point about it. I think that some of the story structure stuff that works time and again, there are valid points that like some of the hero's journey stuff can carry some cultural baggage, right? That, you know, every new time can re-examine and say how much of this we want to keep. But I think at a base level, this idea of the structure of the hero's journey and the way Star Wars plugs into it, stuff like this, I feel like that is a little bit like, I feel like it exists the way rhyme scheme exists.
Yeah.
Outside of us, right? You can have all these discussions about poetry, but you have to admit like ABBA rhyme scheme is a thing. It exists whether you want it to or not. And mm-hmm. So, you know, all the cultural stuff around it aside, the idea of the hero starts out, takes one step back, takes two steps forward, big thing, new status quo, right? Like you move from status quo, like to we see how what the status quo is. There is the call to do something different. There's the refusal of the call. There's the acceptance of the call. Things get worse and worse and worse until they reach a breaking point. Now we're in a new status quo. Like that's the hero's journey at its like most baseline level. So I feel like that just, that's just there. And it is exciting to me to look at that as a basic rhyme scheme for storytelling and realize that you don't have to tell stories that way, but it's a super basic rhyme scheme that you can know. And also now that you know it, what interesting things can you do with it?
Yeah. And a lot of the stories, a lot of the edgy stories, or let's say the experimental stories or the more modern stories, what they're doing is that they're not doing that basic story on purpose to make you notice that they're not doing the basic thing. So even when you kind of go away from this, you know, like, let's say, like you said, like situation, problem, resolution, or return to another situation. Sometimes it doesn't mean that there's an actual resolution of the problem, but a transformation and then to another state. And then if you look at crazy, you know, Dada type storytelling or people try to break that structure, you notice, oh, you're trying to break that structure. And then the structure still continues to exist because you keep trying to break it. So any experimental story ends up in a way even reinforcing that pattern because you notice it as an exception. You see it as something which is trying to be different. And so it just comes back to, it just becomes, like you said, almost like a, it's almost like the pattern of breathing. It's just like how you even recognize that something is a story is because there's, you know, I keep telling people that the world is full of facts, right? The world has a million amounts of facts. So if you string them together and for people to remember it, it's not arbitrary the way you do that. It has to have a certain pattern or else people won't even be able to recognize it as a unit, right? Won't even be able to say that's a story. It's it's framed with a beginning and an end. Right, it has characters that have some kind of continuation inside, or at least some theme or something which holds it together, or else it looks fragmented and we struggle to even remember it. Let's say,
sure, but I do think there are many stories, right? And like, so I do think that you know, like these stories that I think of as rhyme schemes, I still have to admit that there's jazz, right? Like there's still And those kinds of experiments, you know, breaking out of, you know, I'm not a musical expert, but breaking out whatever came before is what leads us to jazz, which brings in its own richness in finding, I don't know, in like new patterns, new ways of doing things. Like, I feel like the same thing happens in mathematics and in, you know, physics and stuff like this. The other thing, though, that called to mind with what you were saying was another thing I've been thinking about a lot is stories as survival information, coded survival information. This is something that I don't know if you're familiar with Brian McDonald, and he's written a book called Invisible Ink. He's got a podcast called the You Are a Storyteller podcast, really good. And he's like a master. He's masterful at talking about story. He's a great screenwriter and storyteller. But he talks about stories as sort of as at their root, like, you know, at a fundamental, like almost evolutionary level, it's coded survival information. You've got the La Brea tar pits. You can find, you know, a saber-toothed tiger in the tar pits. Or no, you can find like, okay, you can find a mammoth in the tar pits. You can find a saber-toothed tiger on top of the mammoth in the tar pits. You don't find a person on top of the saber-toothed tiger on top of them because they had a story about the tar pits. I saw this thing go in there. It didn't come out, right? Story as simple as that. And then there are certain stories, like another proof of it, or like example, I guess, of this would be like, I can say the tortoise and the hare, and you're like, slow and steady wins the race, right? If I sit down a child and I say, now, if you go, sometimes the slower route is the better route to win the race. Like, they're not going to remember that. But if you tell the tortoise and the hare, it's in there, right? And it's in there, and now that you say it, and they immediately are thinking. So I do like to think about that. And I think about living stories as the ones that contain, I don't know, not fact, but truth, or like useful information, useful.
What do you mean by living stories?
I mean, the stories that make it, the stories that I've never thought about like the Darwinism of storytelling, but I mean, like, I don't know, the ones that
survive. Yeah. There's like a meta process that you talked about where it's like the story is about survival. But then the fact that stories survive is also like a meta version of that. Like, this is what I was trying to point to before, the idea of attention, which is that these stories survive because we tell them. Basically, that's what it is. Like, we transmit them to the next generation, and that's why they survive. But there are implicit reasons why we do that, that it's not arbitrary. You know, the horrible sitcom, you know, that in the 90s that we don't even remember the name of, that we don't remember it and we won't pass it on because it just didn't keep our attention. It wasn't good enough, right? It just didn't have what it takes to kind of survive. Whereas other stories do survive. So my question is, one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is the difference between our world, which is full of entertainment stories, which I appreciate. Obviously, I like them. I live in this world. But there's also a way in which this is much different from ancient cultures that had participative story. That is, let's say the ancient Greeks, when they told the stories of the heroes and the gods, that was their heroes, it was their gods, it was their story. So they, by telling the story, they were kind of participating in the story. And so one of the issues I've had right now is that we've kind of moved away from participative storytelling. You know, like the way that you would tell the Iliad or the gospel stories or or the story of George Washington or these types of stories that are part of us. And the superhero stories, which are completely fictional, and that you can't, like, you can cosplay, but you never really enter into the world of Superman, right?
Right, but you never enter into the world of Zeus either. I mean, like,
if you were Greek, then Zeus is your god. You go to the temple, you give sacrifice. Like, you know, there's a sense in which you're actually,
if you're,
like,
if you're a modern person, you go to, you know, San Diego Comic-Con, right? Like, it's. I those two things don't seem that far apart to me. Like, the idea that, like, you are participating in those in the story of the Greek gods, but Zeus is not going to turn into a bull and impregnate you. Right? I mean, like, right?
Well, not you, like, but your ancestors.
Yeah, right, whoever the ancient Greek person, yeah, is not going to, like, encounter Zeus as a bull. Right. And then, like, me as a modern person, I can, like, Adam Savage has just made a tremendous Mark One Iron Man suit and walked around one of the cons in it. Right. It's glorious. And it's just like, yeah, but he's not bulletproof. Right. It's not a working. He doesn't have an actual arc reactor, but he's celebrating that. And they were celebrating that. I'm not sure that the distinction is that different.
Well, I would say the distinction is binding of community. And so let's say you take Zeus. So Zeus, we celebrate Zeus, right? We worship Zeus, and then Zeus binds us together. So when we exist together, right, we know that we're all looking towards Zeus as the thing which holds us. Let's say it's usually not Zeus. Let's say Athena is better, because Zeus is a little far off there. Let's say, so Athena binds us together. And so we worship Athena, you know, we propitiate and we do all these things. We sing to her, but then she is also the guarantor of our community functioning. So one of the reasons why we exist as a community, because we have the same God. Mm-hmm. And we can, so in the fictional world, it's more complicated because we don't have these Like, so we kind of celebrate. So we sell it. Let's say, here's a good example. So let's say we go to Comic-Con or we go to Harry Potter event and we put on the thing and we do the thing and everything. And then we go back to our normal life. And those are disconnected in terms of causality. Whereas in a traditional culture, the, let's say the influence of Athena will be felt all the way into the home when the woman walks in and she lights a candle, whatever they were doing, like she burns some incense or something, which would connect all these levels of reality together, all the way down to, you know, like whatever ritual they were using to include an infant into society, whatever. So it was like, it was a binding of an actual society together, where these stories are more, they're like a, you can kind of participate them in a very particular thing, and then you kind of go back to your mundane reality. I think about it. Maybe you have a solution to this or another way of seeing it, but that's something that I've.
I don't know. I feel like that's not. I don't know. I one of the things I think about a lot is that like how my lived experience is not always the same as everybody. Like I see that this could be a thing, but in my experience, I just feel like I feel like those parallels are so close that it's not, it's tough. Cause I feel like.
So let's take the He-Man story. Like, let's say you have this He-Man experience where you like dressed up as He-Man and you wore it under your clothes as a kind
of. I made it part of myself.
Yeah. And so you have this like He-Man talisman, the He-Man vestment would remind you of the values that He-Man proposed, because he did. Like there were morals at the end of every show. Like it was like, you know, you should act like this and that.
Oh gosh, He-Man. Those guys knew what they were doing.
I think it's great. Like, I think it has, and it works with you. Like it actually had an almost like a liturgical effect on you. People are going to think I'm being a heretic, but almost like a sacramental effect on you. Like you wore the thing, it formed your values, it made you part of the person you are, et cetera, et cetera. And so the question is, does it scale? Like, to me, that's the question. Like, this is why I struggle with these fictional stories. And so it works to a certain extent, but does it scale? Like, can it bind your family together? Like, can He-Man bind your family together? Like, can He-Man bind a community together? Like, hold it in a, like, is there, like, would you initiate your children into He-Man?
I would watch
them. Maybe you would. I don't know. Like, I don't know.
I feel like one of my friends who loves He-Man more than I do, went to PowerCon, right? This is a huge He-Man gathering. He went to PowerCon and he met the guy who voiced Man-at-Arms. And Man-at-Arms said, like, he said something very beautiful to him in the Man-at-Arms voice. And the guy, like, my friend was like, you know, tears were in my eyes. It's amazing. And,
it's like a revelation, like a little apocalyptic.
Yeah, but I see this. I see this with stories. I feel like to say that these stories are, I don't know, lesser or silly or not as important. It makes me nervous. Like I like, yeah because I in my life I have seen people so affected by story and so able to come together with, I owe my whole life to it, honestly. Like finding my group online, these flight artists who we all ended up going on and telling the same kinds of stories, like diving into this. That shaped and formed my life. And, and like, I treasure the moments that we get to see each other in events and things. And I see other people doing this, whether it's the cosplay community or, I can only see the parallels, honestly, because like you go to New York Comic Con and they are selling you things, right? Like, and that's gross maybe, but maybe it's not. But they were selling you stuff at temples too. Like, they were selling those doves that you sacrifice, right? There's always people making a buck off it. So I don't know. And like now I see my youngest daughter, Ronia, she really latched onto the Mandalorian series. Mm-hmm. And it was really beautiful. It was really good. And it was like, that's a whole nother one for me. I kind of wish she never took off the helmet, the mask, because it allows you, Spider-Man is like this. Which is why I cry at the end of Spider-Verse at every time, because they've taken all the responsibility lessons and all the self-sacrificial lessons from Spider-Man and finally said, like, you could be under the mask. It could be.
Yeah, I've talked about that before, but I talked about it in the sense that it's like, it really is the desire for religion, but it's like a weird version of it. Like it's basically saying you could be, you know, you can kind of live in Christ, or you could live, you know, you can manifest this in the world, but it's weird. Cause it's like, no, I mean, not really. Right. I mean, you can't, you're not Spider-Man.
Right. But
or you can't, I'm, like, can you, I don't know. Like, it,
I mean, flip the question. I'm struggling to see how that works the other direction.
Like how it works. So the way it works the other direction is that, for example, you can imitate, or you can imitate Christ, because Christ basically self-sacrificed himself.
Mm-hmm.
And
you can imitate Spider-Man the same way, though.
By sacrificing yourself.
Yeah. Aunt May tells Spider-Man, he's like, sometimes like a hero. Like what did she say? She's like, heroes, I believe there's a hero in all of us. There's like something that makes us noble, keeps us brave.
Yeah, I think that's true, for sure.
Sacrifices. And then it says, and sometimes it means giving up the thing you want most, even your dreams. And I'm still a real sucker for the defining a hero by what he wants and then not giving it to them.
Yeah. I think that for sure in Spider-Man, that's definitely a powerful thing about him, which is that Spider-Man is always sacrificing. That's his story. He's always not getting what he would like to have. And he has to sacrifice that to a higher order.
Right. And that's like, and that's where that, yeah, I don't see.
You don't see the difference.
I don't see the difference completely. No, I mean, I see how it's beautifully human. And I see that Spider-Man is a person given great power, but we all are in some sense. I find those stories honestly also a lot about puberty, really. Like,
yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Times when you change and you become stronger, men and women, happens in different ways and same ways in some ways, but because you just physically get larger, you get to the point where you, whoever you are,
you kind of explore that in the Jack
tantrum. Now you are a danger to your parent.
Yeah, right? Yeah. You explore that a little bit in the Jack series. You get a sense that that's kind of what's going on with Jack as well, like that he's in that transition spot there.
And he has that, like he has that. I feel like Zeta, you know, like I like to have characters who like have flaws, but they're always going to be part. They can control them, right? They learn to control their flaws, but they're not like over it, right? Like Zeta's whole deal is like her story start because she has a little bit of an impulse control problem, right? Yeah. Like if you give her a button, she's gonna push it. Like she can't not. And she probably gets that under control, but it's still her first impulse, right? One of Jack's impulses is to control the situation when really I'm gonna do this. He's like, I'm going to force you not to. And that's one of the points where things kind of go bad for him. And he does it in the next book too. It's like, he doesn't quite get over that. But I like all those values, I guess I feel like this idea that like, oh, some of the Christian values are of sacrifice and all these things are bubbling up in current stories, right? Currently told stories. But I also feel like, I don't know what's specifically Christian about those values, because I found them in Superman and He-Man and Spider-Man, and they just seem like human values. Right. They seem I don't know how the other story is, how is it fundamentally different?
Well, if you look at ancient epics, for example, like the theme of self-sacrifice, at least the way that it's presented in the Christian story, is not really there. It's maybe hinted at. It's sometimes there's something which could maybe be around it. But if you think of Achilles, for example, I always give this example. It's like Achilles in the Iliad is brooding in his tent and doesn't want to participate in the battle because they took his sex slave away from him.
Sure.
And he goes back into battle when they kill his friend. And it's like, all right, now it's time to have revenge over my friend because he was killed. And he goes overboard and there's all this going on. And you see the same with the, like, you know, Hercules is a hero, but he also slaughters his children. Like there's a sense in which the heroes of the ancient world are these terrible kind of figures that are extremely powerful and that you have to fear and kind of, you kind of have to be careful of. Whereas the hero, the Christian hero, which becomes exemplified in the knight, is the hero that has power, which he gives to those that don't have power. And that's basically the basic structure of the hero since the advent of the Christian story. And it's so
serve the less powerful. Yeah,
exactly. And so that becomes like a, just a trope. And then, so you see it in He-Man, you see it in Superman, you see it in every, basically every popular story, because it has, it's been a major transformation. Like it's a major transformation in the way we understand what even hierarchy is, like what the purpose of having these people above us is that they're there to love that which is below, right? The purpose of the leaders is not to just clamp down on us and control us, but is to give back and to kind of to give themselves for those that follow them. So that's that, to me, that's like the major Christian difference between ancient stories and stories. Even you find hints of that in Buddhism. Like there is a sense in the idea of the bodhisattvas who refuse nirvana in order to help those that are still in the world. And so it's like, yeah, that's quite close to the Christian story, but it's not an obvious story. It's obvious to us because we've been living in it for 2000 years, but it's not that obvious in terms of ancient myth for sure.
Okay. Yes. I will grant you that. Definitely. Well, no, I mean, like a lot of the ancient myths is like a lot of the Christian story is the flipping of might makes right to, the flipping of that power structure, right? Yeah. The mighty are there to serve the weak, right? Or that is maybe just our human calling, like to serve those below us. But I am still struggling to see like why there's only one story to tell that. Really?
Well, no, there isn't. It's fractally.
What's wrong with telling it with Spider-Man?
Like, no, there's nothing wrong.
What is lesser about telling it with Spider-Man?
I think.
Once we say like, well, Spider-Man's the one that said, "With great power comes great responsibility." So, but why can't I make a character who also lives the value of "with great power comes great responsibility" and just like Spider-Man's awesome? You can go to Spider-Man if you want, but
yeah,
there are many stories. And the best stories, like the tortoise and the hare, are true, right? But not factual, I guess, is what is the deal. Like you learn from the tortoise and the hare, you know, that very often taking the slower, methodical route gets you to the end first, or if it's a race or whatever.
Yeah.
But then, like, there are times in life when you want to sprint, right? Like, or where that's the correct call, right? Is to just go sprint. But if that story becomes too crystallized and too formalized and too, and that there's if we look back in history, there's an actual turtle that tells you, you've got to take the slow and steady rate. That's otherwise it's a sin, right?
Yeah. No,
okay. That's the story. That's taking the story as true and then conflating it with fact.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Well, for sure that these ancient stories are, they're, how can I say this? They're more organic than that. Like they don't, like you said, that's why in a lot of these ancient tropes, ancient stories, sometimes you'll find like adages that are actually the opposite of each other.
Sure.
And those, it coexists together, right? Because it's like, you say, was it far from, I forget, sorry, I'm French. So it's like, I don't have the adages in English. So far from heart, far from mind. Is that an adage in English?
Oh. Okay, I can see that.
Yeah. Right, so you can say absence makes the heart grow fonder, and then you say far from heart, far from mind.
Yeah, they're different. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So it's like it's actually two opposites. So it's like if you're far away from something, it makes you forget it. If you're far away from it, it makes your heart grow fonder for it.
Right.
They're actually both true, but like you said, you don't want like it to turn into a rule system. Like,
oh, out of sight, out of mind.
Out of sight, out of mind. Sorry. Like, sorry. I just don't, I'm French people.
I was like, I know it's in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, but to come back to the idea of, to me, it's all about participation. Like I said, that's why I don't see it. Like you don't have to see it as opposed. I think that there's a way in which these, let's say the Christian story bubbles down, like bubbles up and kind of fills up and manifests itself in all these different stories. And that's great. It's actually wonderful that happens. But there's also a way in which, like I said, I see when you say go to Comic-Con and everything, I get it. Like there's something, it's not nothing, but it's not.
Say it about the Mandalorian. I don't mean to interrupt you, but
yeah, go ahead.
But I feel like I'm going to forget this. I feel like watching my daughter, my little daughter, she's 10 and she latched on the Mandalorian and now she's got a helmet and we're like making her some Beskar armor. And we all as a family enjoyed watching this series together, like as an event. And then now she plays Mandalorian in the yard with her friend. And, you know, like they've got, and they build it out of Legos. They build little worlds, little Mando worlds out of Legos. And then also when we, if you play that opening theme, that music that goes along with it, like, it's just one of those things where we're all there, right? You can blast that through the house. And it's just like, it's not.
It's real. Like, yeah, I'm not questioning it.
It's not quite as formally ritualized, but on the other hand, it's young.
Yeah, but it's also not like, I think that it's the, to me, it's the, like, so let me paint you the other portrait, right? Which is a village that has a church in the middle mm-hmm. of the village. And it, the building is actually higher than all the other buildings. So when you look out your window, when you're walking around, you can always see the steeple above as the point of reference for all the people in the village. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like in the Catholic village, let's say at 12, the bell rings and then we're all at the same time in the village praying together. Mm-hmm. So we know, we can't see people doing it, but we know that the entire village is praying together at the same time, kind of looking towards the central space. And then on Sundays, we kind of go into the church. Everybody kind of goes into the church together. Then people celebrate the same thing. And then we move out and we go back into our homes and we have a fractal version of that, which is that at meals. And like I said, when the bell rings, then we'll have this celebration we do together. So what it does is it creates, so this is, the community is bound together by this common celebration. And so in these fictional world, which like I said, it works, like in The Mandalorian, what happens is you have these little things that pop up, but we're watching society kind of fragment. Mm-hmm. So like our suburbs are just, you know, suburbs have no center. Suburbs have no place of communion, right? Suburbs have no common goal or common project. Sure. And so it's like this breakdown. And it's manifesting itself in all these little smaller versions of liturgy, like you said, The Mandalorian or Marvel or Star Wars and all these, or manga or whatever. But ultimately, it's, you can feel this breakdown. Yeah.
Okay. No, I mean, I've lived there, so I will.
I have that village.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. We've spent, all put together. We'd go to the Gravina Montale in Italy. This is where my wife's family is from. And it's a little village. Like I think at its height, maybe like 300 people live there. Now it's more like 60, less than that now, because it's very old. In the middle of it, it is, you know, the church, highest point, more or less. It's on a mountain slope. So it's, bell rings. San Bartolomeo is the church. I've marched with San Bartolomeo in his flayed skin.
Okay.
In the procession around the town. And it's beautiful, right? Like I totally grant that it's beautiful and it's binding. True, right? And I can see that is healthy, particularly for small communities to have, but I don't know. And I also will, like, I don't know how to solve the suburb problem. I get that's a, and I apologize for this guy out here.
No worries.
He's having crazy time. But I guess my thing is, like, would you say like the ancient communities with like the Greek communities had something similar?
Yeah, they definitely did. And I mean, I think that it's a traditional trope. I think for sure the difference is that, let's say in a Roman or Greek community, you had that pattern, but it didn't necessarily have the love part as this aspect that we talked about, which is that at least ideally, there's a sense in which the father is also there to help his children, right? It's like it was a more hierarchical thing where the household would just submit to the father, and it was, which is something which exists in the traditional Christian world as well. But at least in the story and in the ideal, there's a sense in which there's a top down thing kind of coming down as well. And so I think it's a universally traditional system. It just, the difference is, in my opinion, in the Christian story, you have a balance between this kind of top down structure and the idea of how the lesser, all the smaller people are the hero image that we talked about, the idea of the person above giving themselves for those that follow him and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But it is a universal pattern. It's not just a Christian one. That's 100% sure.
Which part's a universal pattern? The
idea of binding ritual, like the idea of ritual, of celebrating, you know, of sacrificing, all of these gestures that we pose to kind of connect ourselves with something higher and then bind ourselves to those that are around us.
Okay. So were the Greeks in their rituals, were they more closer to what you'd say, like the, I don't know, Mandalorian or Marvel Cinematic Universe or something like that?
What do you mean?
Well, you keep saying like, well, it's different with these fictional stories.
Yeah.
Right. Were the Greeks operating under a fictional story?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
So are you asking if I think the gods exist? Yes, I think the gods exist.
And Zeus included.
I think Zeus exists, of course. The gods, I think I'm on a Neil Gaiman side with that. I think all the gods exist. Sorry, I guess you didn't expect that one.
No, this is super interesting. In what way, maybe we're not understanding this. Maybe we don't know maybe we're not using the same exist in the same way.
Like, I don't know. How do you use the word exist?
Are you saying they exist in the way that an idea exists?
They exist in a way multiplicity becomes one. Like they exist in a way that they are principalities that manage bodies, that manage aspects of reality.
Hmm. Like you're a little bit beyond me. I'm not exactly sure what you're saying.
So
I'm totally interested, though. I am interested. I'm struggling.
So think of it like, let's say a city, right?
Right.
And so does a city exist?
Sure.
Right. But it's also, I mean, where? Like it's a very fluid thing. Like it's a body, right?
It exists materially, it exists as an event as well.
Right. But you can, for example, be a New Yorker, but still like be in Miami, for example. Like you could participate in New York, but while physically being in Miami.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So it exists. So the way it exists is complicated. It's not a simple thing. And so it exists under something like a principality, right? In scripture, there's that idea. It's like the angel. There's an angel of a city. Mm-hmm. And it's a being, just like you have a bunch of stuff in you, like your body. And your body extends even into your books and into the things you say online and the notes that you've written. Right. It's like your body is a lot bigger than what we think when we think of you just as this guy that is there, let's say that I could touch or that's right in front of me. Right. Your being extends beyond that. It's not as contained as sometimes we think. And so the way that there's a part of you or an aspect of you, which is one, it's like your spirit, your soul, like whatever word you want to use, the pattern which unites all this multiplicity that makes it recognizable. That exists at different levels of reality. It just doesn't exist for people. It exists for cities, it exists for passions, which is why we say there are demons, like the demon of lust or the demon of this. Like it's a coherent body, which is managed by a pattern, which is
what do you mean?
Which makes you recognize it is a way to understand that.
Can a demon affect the material world?
Well, of course, but not materially.
Not materially, not directly.
Yeah, just like your thoughts can affect the material world too, not purely. Like your will can affect the world. You just not materially. Your will doesn't affect it directly. So you can have spiritual action at a distance, right? You can ask your wife to bring you a cup of coffee, and if she does, then you're affecting the physical world through meaning, through spirit, right?
Hmm. that's a lot. That's a lot to chew on.
Sorry.
Can I ask another question? Like,
yeah.
What about like, so, okay. So Zeus in some sense exists. Could there be a new one? Could there be new gods that will exist?
Well, they wouldn't be new. They could, their bodies could appear in time. That's for sure. So
we discover new gods that always did exist.
Well, that not always. The word always is complicated because it implies, how can I say this? It's like you could say that all things exist eternally in the mind of God is the best way to understand that. And then they manifest themselves in time and space, but that they obviously all of them have an eternal, like a non-space, non-time existence. Mm-hmm. So of course they could be, but I would say it may be yes and no. Like it's complicated. Like, of course, all. So there's a theory, like a Thomistic theory, and it's a theory that a lot of ancient Christians accepted, which is that it's every time there's a communion between beings, there's an angel. So there's myriads and myriads of angels. Like, you know, every time, like there's an angel for our conversation because our conversation is more than the sum of its parts.
Are there angels for our tangents?
What do you mean by our tangents?
Is there an angel for the He-Man part of our conversation and an angel for the
is there an angel of He-Man?
No. It's like you say there is an angel for our conversation.
For the communion, for the fact that we're coming together, like the union of a multiplicity into one. So as soon as multiplicity kind of joins and you can recognize something.
Are they distinct angels?
Yeah, they're distinct angels. They don't necessarily.
Okay, what if we have another podcast? Angels. Is that a different angel or is that the same angel coming back for the next podcast, the next conversation, where we double down on all this stuff?
It'd be interesting to think about.
I don't know. Where's that's an idea that doesn't really have an end.
No, it doesn't. I mean, that's why it's like I'm not saying that this is necessarily the best way to kind of understand reality, but it's definitely a one which ancient Christians have accepted, not just ancient Christians, like even, you know, like even in Hinduism, we have this kind of idea, right? That there are myriads and myriads of principalities.
Okay.
But it's the problem. It's a problem of complexity. Like it's not a religious problem. It's a problem of how we're able to perceive unity in multiplicity, because it's like, you think it's obvious that you have a bunch of stuff in front of you and all of a sudden you see it as one thing. It's like, why are you seeing it as one thing? Not one thing, it's a bunch of things. And that bunch of things also has another bunch of things at a lower level, right? It's a stacking up of bunch of things, but then somehow you're able to perceive one. So how is it that you're this one, where is it? Right. So that's the ontological problem that these questions are trying to pose. It's not a new
philosophical or physics problem. Right. Where does one thing end and the other thing begin? Like But I mean, like, I don't know. I've been reading a ton of physics and it gets slipperier and slipperier the more you look at stuff. And that I can get on board with. And I do like the idea that the edges of things, that reality is granular and the edges of things are kind of fuzzy.
Yeah, they have margins and they're like the corners of the fields, right? That you need to leave untilled, or the fringe on the vestment, the fringe on the garment. There's a messiness on the border.
Sure. But I don't know. I struggle with talking about principalities and angels as in that sense as being useful for understanding it. Like, at least it's not the most useful thing in my toolbox currently, mental toolbox. I guess I'll say
like,
that.
It's like, I'm not going there.
Like, you're coming up with some interesting stuff, but I'm struggling to get it, I guess.
Yeah, that's okay. I mean, it's not, I didn't expect us to go in this direction anyways, yeah. In this conversation. I'm like, I kind of pulled you into a world that's difficult. It's not the way that modern people think, let's say. But it's definitely something that is, it's coming up in the problem of complexity and the problem of emergence. Like, how is it that how do these phenomena coagulate into one, right? How is it that quantum fields stack up so that you can say, you know, it's like, you can say that's Ben. And it's like, that's a pretty intense thing that I can notice you, that you have unity. Cause you're a bunch of stuff, not just a bunch of stuff in space, but a bunch of stuff in time. And the fact that these join together into one being is something which is difficult to account for. Unless you have something like a Platonic structure,
the ideals that exist outside of everything, the one true apple.
Yeah. Right. But it's not that's why in the Christian vision, or at least in the Orthodox vision, it's not that simple. It's like, it's not just that the apple, the form of the apple exists outside the apples. It's that it exists within all the apples, right? And the apples exist within it. It's not disincarnated. It's an incarnated, metaphysics, you could say. But it's not like there's a world of the forms of apples, mm-hmm. right? And then there are the particular apples. It's that this is actually, it's an incarnate reality. Right? The form of the apples are, you could say, hiding in the apples, and the apples are in the form so that you're able to perceive the apples as a discrete thing. It's like, sorry, man. I feel like this is going like way off to the kind of things.
But let me rope it back into the.
Yeah, all right. Talk about the storytelling.
Well, I'm thinking like the one, I guess I get nervous when all of it leads to there being one true story, which is also definitively historical and therefore has primacy over every other story.
Like the story of Jesus.
That relegates all the other stories to being glimmers of the one true story. And that is an idea that I have grown uncomfortable with.
Yeah. But there's another way to present it, which is not necessarily all the idea that they're just glimmers, but that there's a, how can I say this? There's like a fractal reality, which is that reality is full of, let's say, the story of logos, right?
Right. But that's the logos. That's the logos, the whole thing. You're giving a fractal reality a center.
Yeah. That you mean the fact that that the story of Jesus like encapsulates, let's say, all these stories together.
And then by definition has to be factual in a way that the story of Zeus is not historical.
Zeus is not embodied.
Leda and the swan. Did that happen?
Sorry?
Leda and the swan? I don't know. Take it. Why am I on a Zeus kick today? That's so weird.
Yeah.
But any one of the people who was who Zeus dressed like turned into animal Zeus and got pregnant.
Yeah.
Why am I on that today?
Why are we talking about all of Zeus's rapes? Is that what you're wondering?
Yeah. It's an interesting psychological question going on here. But did that happen?
So you could say that it didn't happen in the same way that we say that the story of Jesus happened.
George Washington crosses the Delaware, the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
Right. And so there's a hierarchy of events in the world, and they don't necessarily happen at the same level, you know, and some of them have more intensity and more brightness, and some of them are less incarnate also as well, you could say. And so for sure, the way that Zeus impregnated his different ladies is not the same way that we talk about the resurrection, let's say, or that we talk about the story of Christ. But to say that it didn't happen, I think is pushing it.
Do we talk about the resurrection of Christ in a similar way to the signing of the?
No, I hope not. I hope nobody does that. Because it's obviously not at the same level. It's a different level. It's hinted at in the scripture, right?
Closer to the Zeus level than to the.
I mean, the idea would be that it's a place where it all comes together. And so in a way it is something that happened, but something which is beyond description at the same time. But it's not a fable. At least no Christians believe that it was a fable, like that it was something that happened in a more subtle way, let's say. So a lot of the old stories are more subtle. Like they seem to be happening at the psychic level, or seem to be happening at a psychic level of the version of a community, like something like that. Like, you know how you have ideas and imaginations. And so let's say a community can have that as well. And so a lot of these stories seem to happen at that level. And so they're not exactly the same as let's say the stories about Jesus.
Okay. Those stories are happening at more of a psychic level, which is different from the story of Jesus. Was it happening at a more psychic level than say, Ford making the first Model T? I don't know.
Yeah, you're trying to find something that is historical.
There seems to be like a what do you call it?
A continuum of some kind.
Continuum of types of events. Yes. Yeah, so like we have like the more psychic events, which are like Zeus. We have more historical events like the first light bulb. Things that you can like point to, you have, you know, and then we have like where on this continuum is say the resurrection.
The resurrection is very singular because it's presented as both an event which obviously happened in a way that people could recognize it as happening, like it's happening in the world, but it also points, it's difficult to contain because the disciples don't recognize Jesus. They don't recognize him, and then they do when he reveals himself. And so it's very mysterious. I think it's made to be mysterious. It's made to be mysterious on purpose so that you don't think that it's as mundane as, you know, you cutting your fingernails, but that it's also not something which is imaginary or a fable, but that it somehow is a place where all of this kind of comes together.
And that's why it's got primacy and we can toss out Zeus, but not that.
We don't have to toss out Zeus. Like, I mean, we don't worship Zeus, but people remember the story of Zeus, right?
About things that bring communities together. It does not have to be Athena.
Yeah. Well, the stories of the Greek gods ended up participating in the margins of Christian civilization. Like they were remembered and they were, they were remembered and copied and celebrated as lower on the hierarchy of things, let's say, to remember. But they weren't forgotten. Like, there were statues of the Greek heroes in Constantinople, of the Roman heroes and Greek heroes in Constantinople. Like, they were, you know, they were just part of society.
But then the Norse myths are alive and well now, with Thor being in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
Like literal Thor. So it's like, so I get like, but that's more of the evolution of story. Like, that's an organic, I don't know, like stories in time, growing, changing, being adopted by different people for different reasons and different ways.
Yeah, but there are ways, like, I mean, it'd be interesting to look at it, because there are ways in which the story of Jesus, let's say just the actual story of Jesus, that it takes storytelling to its limit. And so it's very difficult sometimes to imagine how you could go beyond some of the stories that are told, let's say, in his story. So, like, the story of the descendant to the underworld is a good example that I like to use, which is that the descendant to the underworld is like a universal story. You see it in every culture. It's always there. Like, there are versions of it, different aspects of it. You know, you go down to visit, to get some wisdom. You go down to save someone, you succeed or you don't succeed. You know, and so you see it in the epics, and you see it in the different myths. And so now Jesus has a version, which is to go down into the underworld. And then he goes down into death, and then he takes everybody out.
Mm-hmm.
And then he destroys death. And so that's the end of that story. So it's not like, I mean, you can participate, you can have other versions of it still. Like, it's still kind of fractally will continue to manifest itself. But it's reached a limit of storytelling, which is that story of the descent into the underworld has kind of reached its, yeah, like, their death is abolished. You could say, why is it that they're the ones who thought of telling that version? Like, I mean, you could kind of find,
if that's the one true, best, ultimate version of that story, the fullness of the underworld story, as me sitting here, I have two questions. So first question, number one, with that being the fullness of the underworld story, I sit here today with the book on my desk is writing an underworld story.
Yeah.
That I feel that marginalizes my underworld story a little bit. But like, why would I, the best has already been done. All I can do is be a glimmer or a fractal reflection of that story.
Right. But that's not like the idea of being a fractal reflection of the ultimate story is something that that's always what we've been doing. It's not like, this was always what's been going on. Like, it's always been a fractal reflection of some story, which we recognize. And then we're kind of participating in, and we're showing different sides of, and then everybody can kind of see that this is connecting us to something which we can't totally describe, or that stirs us in a way that we can't completely exhaust. But that continues to be true because the point, let's say, where that story comes together has happened. It doesn't mean that there isn't this like joy of participating in it. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't affect me. Like, I would still tell an underworld story, because Dante still told an underworld story, and it was one of the best underworld stories to ever happen, but it didn't reach the limit, let's say, of the story of Christ. Like, it didn't, it actually participates in it, because it, even in Dante's story, you get this sense of how all of this has been transformed by that event, and how it's also even more interesting hints about how, yeah, anyways, I won't go into that, but yeah, sorry.
Okay. So what about this? Like, I'm having a hard time figuring out where the line is between, and the way we're talking about it now is takes a lot of thought. But I have this idea, like, do you think if you could see the historical Christ, Jesus of Nazareth, we'll say, and find that this is a historical person, and could view that history or travel back to that history and see, would you think you would be disappointed? The reason I'm asking, can I just
yeah, go ahead,
to flesh out that question, my other totem that I have here with me. So I had Prince Adam. I also have Robin Hood.
Yeah.
Here, who I love. And my daughter Angelica gave me this plastic Disney Robin Hood, because I love Disney's Robin Hood. But, you know, like, Robin Hood's hard to figure out where it all came from. But, you know, it's possible that there are like a couple like early medieval contenders for maybe the origin of the Robin Hood story. I feel like if I went back and met one of those guys, with, you know, Disney's beautiful Fox Robin Hood, with Errol Flynn, with the many other versions in my mind, it would be nothing short of a disappointment.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I think that's part of the story. It's actually in the Jesus story, what you're saying. Right? In the Jesus story is people being disappointed in Jesus and not him not seeming to be what they expected him to be. And so your the way you think about it is completely right, but it's contained in the story. So there's a sense in which the Logos is hidden in his manifestation, and the fruits of that, of his hiddenness, appear as the story continues to unfurl. And so when Christ resurrects, that, you know, or when the when there's when they receive the Holy Spirit, you get a sense that all of a sudden they see all these little aspects of his story, and they're able to connect them in a way that at the time they were too blind to kind of see. But I think you're right. I think that probably if I was there, especially without the knowledge that I have now, I would probably be one of those people that didn't recognize the Messiah because yeah, that's exactly how the story is actually told.
Interesting. That's good. No, this is all very interesting stuff.
We should probably go. I mean, it'd be nice to have another conversation.
I have run out of questions.
You run out of questions. Well, listen, I'm sorry I kind of took you on this. I didn't expect it to kind of go in this direction.
It was a wild ride.
It was a wild ride. So thank you for your time, and thank you especially for your books. And once again, I want to encourage people to especially if you have kids that are, you know, kind of middle school age, even from like, I mean, younger is fine too, and even for adults as well. Like, they're just really great stories and very positive and very boisterous, great characters. So I really appreciate what you've done, and I'm happy to that you were willing to talk to me.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
All right, and also maybe remind people of the upcoming book,
Julia's House Goes Home. I had a blast, particularly illustrating this one with my watercolors. So I'm happy with the story, I feel like it ended well enough. So,
and Ben, think about all the things you talked about. Let it mull over. I'll also think, because you really provoke me more than a lot of people in terms of the fiction story. And it's like, I've been just saying this, and now you're like, oh, pushing here. So yeah. I'll think about it as well. And maybe we'll have another conversation at some point.
Maybe we will. Thank you so much.
All right. It was good to meet you.
I want to present you a new series of graphic novels called God's Dog. God's Dog is a very loose and epic exploration the legend of the dog-headed warrior saint Christopher, one of the most surprising and peculiar traditions of the ancient medieval world. It was written as a screenplay by myself and my brother Mathieu over 10 years ago, and the story was taken up and even recommended by a script scouting agency. It was requested by several Hollywood studios, but this story was, of course, too big, too strange, too surprising for Hollywood. And so now, with all the control of its potential, we bring you this groundbreaking story in full color as a series of graphic novels. The story is set in a Tolkien-style mythical version of the biblical world, filled with hidden codes, ancient relics, angels, giants, dragons, and populated with fictional versions of mysterious monks, warrior saints, and more symbolism than you can imagine. God's Dog contains all the intensity and subtlety of our symbolic thinking, the world-class layouts and artwork of Cord Nielsen, all of this bound in a mysterious and powerful story arc which is available to all, from wide-eyed 10-year-olds to the most seasoned of readers. The entire story, with all its action and complexity, is already completely worked out, and the first book is near completion. Now all we need to do is deliver it to you. We're crowdfunding this because it is only the first step. We've already been contacted by even international publishers for this. But we want to knock this out of the park so that our artists can do this full time and deliver the oncoming books at a regular and steady pace under our control. I myself will personally not be taking any profit from this first book, but rather I want to use this to build what we need to tell this full epic with all its cosmic proportions. So along with the graphic novel, we are also producing a crowdfunding-only add-on, The Secrets of God's Dog Sourcebook, a beautiful volume in which you will find my original drawings from more than 10 years ago, an exploration of the symbolism of St. Christopher, and an exclusive text by Mathieu Pajot on the symbolism of the biblical Samson. This is the first thing that Mathieu has published since his groundbreaking book, The Language of Creation. So jump into the margins with us. Be part of this shift in storytelling, where the end becomes the beginning and where the monster carries the king into a new world. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Symbolic World. The Symbolic World is based on a series of videos that you can find on my YouTube channel, Jonathan Pajot's YouTube channel. You can also get involved. There is a Facebook group that has started by fans of the podcast called The Symbolic World Within the Zombie Invasion. I will put a link to that in the show description. And so it is a discussion of all things symbolism that is quite interesting. I'd like to drop in there and also leave some of my comments as well. You can always help the podcast by, of course, leaving a review on iTunes. Everybody knows that's the best way to get the podcast out there, to get it heard. And if you want to get involved, you can also support the podcast financially going to www.thesymbolicworld.com/support or else on Patreon, the Pajot videos as well, and on Subscribestar. All those links you can find on my website or in the show description. So thank you, and I will see you soon.